I'm Christina Mulligan. I'm a professor at Brooklyn Law School, and I teach intellectual property and technology law.
I'm Kurt Opsahl, Deputy General Counsel at the Electronic Frontier Foundation. So I'm working on a lot of cases trying to defend your rights in the digital age.
Blair Chintella, I'm also an attorney. I practice here in Atlanta, and I do some criminal work, do copyright work as well. So.
Excellent. So the topic here is about cell phones and whether a warrant is required. And actually, the Supreme Court has answered that question very recently in two cases, Riley and Worry, that were decided, what was that decided a couple months ago?
June 25th.
June 25th. So this is a hot topic. Basically, this was trying to deal with the search incident to arrest doctrine. This is the notion that when the police are arresting you, they can search you for, you know, looking for weapons and things in your pocket. And there was sort of a generalized notion that, let's say, if you had a piece of paper in your pocket, they could look at that piece of paper and see what was on it. And the police said, well, if we can do that, we can look at your phone, too. I mean, it's just the same thing, right? It's in your pocket. But this raised a lot of issues, a lot of questions, because what you have on your cell phone is far different from any kind of piece of paper you might have in your pocket. It can be a sort of a window into your entire lives. With a modern smartphone, it could have thousands of email messages, photos documenting, you know, everything that you've been doing, you know, since you got the phone. With apps, there could actually be access to information that's stored elsewhere. So it becomes basically the ability of the police to rummage through your entire life. And so some civil liberties organizations like EFF and others, we felt very strongly that there should be a warrant before you can get this information. And it was kind of a mixed result in some of the courts until finally in June, the Supreme Court resolved the question and said, yes, you do need to get a warrant before looking at this information. You can't use the search incident to arrest doctrine to avoid the warrant requirement. And in the course of that opinion also said some very strong language that I think will be helpful in cases moving forward.
So to contextualize this opinion in terms of how the Supreme Court's been looking at Fourth Amendment and technology recently, I wanted to bring up another recent case the Supreme Court decided, U.S. versus Jones. And in that case, the question had been, so, you know, there's this idea of plain view. If the police sees you, if a police officer sees you walking down the street, they can follow you. And that's not a search, because what you're doing is out in public. And in the Jones case, the police had attached a GPS tracker to somebody's car and tracked exactly where that car was for about a month. And the question was, you know, is that an inappropriate search that you would need a warrant for in order to do legally? Or is this just taking the plain view doctrine to its, you know, natural extension? Like, you could have gotten cops to, like, watch the car 24/7 for days and days and days without triggering the warrant requirement, and so would putting a little GPS tracker on a car not just be the same thing that wouldn't require a warrant? And in that case, the Supreme Court also said, no, that requires a warrant too. And reading this case and the GPS case together suggests the Supreme Court is kind of on the cusp of recognizing that technology has fundamentally changed the way the data can be collected and exists. And that because it's so, like, the quantitative difference in the amount of data generated or that can be generated by technology creates a qualitative difference in what the police are able to access. And so reading those two opinions, it sort of looks like the Supreme Court might be on the cusp of changing the rules to be much more protective of people's privacy rights and take it, you know, and really kind of revamping the way that law looks entirely. You know, several decades ago, the rules had been that, you know, a search required to kind of touch something. And when there were telephones and people were listening in on calls, you weren't touching something in somebody's house, even if you were listening to what they were saying in someone's house. And the Supreme Court, in a decision called Katz, totally changed the rules for what counted as a search, creating this idea of, well, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in what you're doing? If so, the police would generally need a warrant. And I think we're at one of those other constitutional moments where the rules might radically change. And it's really kind of cool to be sitting here beforehand and seeing where that might go.
Absolutely. And one of the key, I guess, aspects of these cases is that they view data in the aggregate instead of, you know, like a single picture or a single text message or something. They lump it together and say, you know, over a period of time, you can see, you know, where a person is by aggregating this data together. You know, I took a picture here, I did this, I made a phone call to this number, and then I checked out this website. You can kind of combine and deduce a person's entire life, essentially, from like aggregating this data. And so with the recent 2014 case, Chief Justice Roberts really kind of delved into that as far as, you know, on a cell phone you have pictures, have GPS locations when you take pictures. I don't know if many people know that, but your cell phone has a GPS sort of sensor in it. I'm not a techie, so I don't know exactly what you call it, but anyway, there's a lot of metadata associated with even a picture, emails, everything from your browser search history, on and on and on. And so really that was one of like the rationales for the court's opinion, is that, you know, aggregating all this data, you really, it tells you a whole different story, more than just the sum of its parts, like each individual little piece of information would. And so hopefully that, you know, foreshadows some positive developments from a civil liberties perspective from the Supreme Court. I reviewed some cases preparing, and there was actually a lot of bad case law on this third party doctrine. And I think I mentioned it to Christina real quickly, but there's probably many a law review article been written on this third party doctrine, which is the idea that if you give your information to a third party, then you automatically lose any expectation of privacy. And so the question I pose is, you know, well, how can you interact in the modern world without giving your information to somebody? So, you know, whether it be like cloud computing or, you know, Gmail account or whatever, you know, you're connected with some other entity, and, you know, you could argue that's just giving away your information. And I just don't think that just broad rule is sustainable in, you know, modern age with all these technological developments and everything. So overall, you know, the recent case is very good, and it kind of foreshadows what will hopefully be some positive developments in that area. So,
yeah. Actually, the third-party doctrine, so this came from Smith v. Maryland is probably the key case that the government relies on there, and that was saying that, you know, the records you have with a phone company are, you voluntarily sort of given them up to the phone company, and therefore you don't have an expectation of privacy on it. And that was a case that was just dealing with looking at the records of one person, a suspect for, I believe it was for doing obscene phone calls, and they looked at a few records of who they called. And from that case, so much has stemmed. A lot of the phone record program the NSA does is based a lot on the Smith v. Maryland third-party doctrine, where they say, well, if we can get one person's phone records, we can get them all. And this has been what the executive, at least the Department of Justice, has been trying to push, is that if something is okay in a particular instance, it's also okay to use it at massive scales, so that when you have technologies that can expand the ability to surveil or get information, you can then apply the reasoning that allowed you to get a little bit of information very, very broadly. And they actually tried to use that doctrine in the cell phone case, the Riley decision, where the government had argued that because the information on the phone was also being uploaded elsewhere, that you not only would lose your expectation of privacy in the cloud and the remote storage, but that changed the character of the information, so you lost it on your phone as well, even though the phone was not in the possession of a third party. Anyway, the Supreme Court rejected that argument, And actually was very concerned about the ability to, if someone got the phone, to look at information stored elsewhere. And so I feel as this suggests, at least, that it might, the time might be ripe for them to reconsider the third-party doctrine. Shall we open for questions?
I mean, that'd be great.
All right. We got the box.
Okay, anybody have any questions?
Speaking through the box.
What's the impact of encryption on the availability or the searchability if they've got a warrant and your data is encrypted? What rights or what do they have to tell you to decrypt the info?
So with encryption, a lot of the cases, there's been some mixed bags on encryption, but it seems to be at least the growing consensus is that the Fifth Amendment protects your right to not give up your password, particularly in cases in which doing so would be this sort of term testimonial, that it would show that you had control over that information, that it would give the government some additional information. However, there's also a doctrine that is they already know in some cases what's on there or. They call it the inevitable disclosure doctrine. They can order you to give up the decrypted version of it if they know that it's yours and is not going to be testimonial. So you still don't have to give up your password, but you might end up being in the same spot, being required to give over the decrypted material. But the advantage of encryption is that they still have to come to you, and you can fight this in the court. You can say that this is, protected, violates your Fourth Amendment rights for them to get it, and if it's not encrypted, they might just take it. So, encrypt your materials.
And I guess what you just said touches on something very pernicious about the third-party doctrine in the digital age, which is that you don't necessarily, if someone wants to, if the government wanted to look in your file cabinet, you would see that either they show up and knock or that they knocked down the door and that your cabinet is open. And, something has happened. Whereas if you store your email on a webmail server, you don't necessarily know that someone has looked at it because there's no broken-in door. Or whatnot. The Fifth Amendment thing is so, it's neat because it's so nuanced, right? Because the thing that is the testimonial aspect is that you know what the password is. Because if they don't know, if it is not already established that they know that you know the password, that by giving it up, you're saying, I admit that I know how to access this data. And that's the potentially incriminating thing that you don't have to give up based on our Fifth Amendment.
I think there's recently a case about that too with the founder of this service called LavaBit. I don't know if you all have heard of that, but supposedly that was a service that Edward Snowden used to facilitate some of his leaking or whatever you want to call it. But I guess the guy, I can't remember his name, but
Ladar,
he was forced or ordered to release these encryption keys. And so I think the first thing what he did is sort of like a, I don't know how you want to phrase it, but middle finger to the government. He basically printed out in tiny, tiny, minuscule font these long, 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 long encryption keys he gave to the government. They said, "Oh, that's
they
not acceptable."
They didn't find that amusing.
Yeah, right. So there are ways they can get it, but a lot of the times it's about how fast they can get it because records are deleted or whatnot. So that case is still in court, actually.
One of the things that was somewhat disturbing about that case was that this was the encryption key to all of the messages that were on the service. So he had thousands, hundreds of thousands, I think, of customers, and the system was set up so that there was a single key that would encrypt and decrypt things as those customers were communicating with it, which is actually not that unusual in websites. So they wanted to get a hold of that, which in order to get at a particular person's email account, but they would have to therefore get the keys to everybody's at the same time. And that is somewhat overbroad, at least in my view. He ended up shutting down the service then giving
them
the key.
Yeah. And this story gets at the tension between law and technology sometimes, and that, in this particular case, the government wanted Snowden's emails. The only technological way to get them in this particular case was to decrypt everybody's ability to communicate, or to decrypt the process by which, to decrypt everything that was being communicated, what's the best way to handle when what the law wants to do isn't what the tech allows easily, and how do you square that circle?
All right, to continue the conversation that this gentleman had earlier about passwords, I know that the Supreme Court ruling you just mentioned pretty much rules out not accessing a cell phone without a warrant. Before this ruling, what was the interpretation of the courts and for using non-encryption access control systems like PIN pads, passcodes, if they were enabled on a phone? What was the ruling before the Supreme Court ruling was ever in effect?
As far as a password, I'm not aware of any case that specifically addresses like a password and how it affects your reasonable expectation of privacy, actually. Maybe Kurt or Christina are, but...
The question that was raised in this was whether the search would be allowed as a search incident to arrest, and not really focusing so much on the reasonable expectation of privacy prong.
Okay.
It's probably a good idea to have a PIN code to protect it. That probably won't stop a police forensics department from being able to access it. You can actually go to Apple if you use an iPhone, and they have a law enforcement guidelines there, and you can see sort of them describe exactly what they can do to get access to a phone if they insist upon a warrant, but what they can do to get access to it. So, you know, if you want to have it protected, do more than a PIN and do encryption.
And to kind of contextualize the case more, this case didn't deal with whether you had to give up your password if the police wanted to search your cell phone. The sort of existing rationale had been, you know, when they're arresting you, the police have two interests. One is to protect themselves, so they don't want them to be in the process of arresting someone and then someone to just, like, pull out a gun and then, you know, injure a lot of people, and also to prevent, like, destruction of evidence that might be on the person. And so even though in a lot of cases, things you might search wouldn't have been relevant to those two things, you know, the Supreme Court had said, listen, we don't, like, let's just have a nice, simple blanket rule that you can search the person and something in their, and whatever sort of in their wingspan, so that, you know, we're not doing this kind of ad hoc weighing and making police nervous about what they can look at and not look at when their, you know, personal safety might be at risk. And so this case ended up being an exception to that, or kind of saying the exception doesn't apply to the massive amount of data. You can still, like, open the phone to check to make sure it does, you know, it's not a bomb on the inside or something sort of silly like that. But, you know, so you can still, that the exception applies in that sense, but it's like, listen, those two interests aren't served by looking at the data on the phone. So before this case, you know, if the police had, like, looked at the phone and typed in, like, 1111, and that turned out to be your password, that wouldn't have been problematic. The Fifth Amendment issue is whether they can make you say the password, because that reveals something about yourself.
My question is, did the cell phone Supreme Court case refer to anything in the cloud?
Yes, it did.
How does the third party doctrine affect what you have on the cloud? I mean, me personally, I don't put anything on the cloud because I haven't figured out how secure it is. I'm not that tech savvy either. But I mean, you know, I have a hard time trying to figure out, you know, how somebody cannot get my things out of the cloud.
I was amazed.
I'm wondering if this case, you know, or the third party doctrine would affect things that you have stored in the cloud.
I was amazed by, because I'm not a techie again, but I was amazed by this cloud storage idea. Just, I mean, I worked at this law firm for a short time, and they stored everything in the cloud. I was like, well, how do you know that information is secure for your clients? And so I was just thought about it. Okay, so it's information stored on some server somewhere. You don't know if it's just some hacker guy maybe owning it or something. So, I mean, I don't fully understand the benefit of the cloud. Maybe you can access it wherever you go or something, right?
That's the primary benefit.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, like, you know, the cloud is a buzzword now, and it really just means remote storage. I mean, if you use Gmail, you're using the cloud. You know, that's your emails being stored with a third party. In fact, pretty much most people are using some form of remote storage for their email because they don't operate an email server in their house. Probably only very few very technical people operate email services in your house. So you're raising some questions that it did come up in the cell phone case talking about the ability to access things, but I think this is actually a little bit of a larger issue, which is what happens when they go to the service provider. So they go to Gmail and say, we want to get this person's email messages. Or they go to Facebook and say, well, we want to get this person's Facebook posts. And the government would assert, well, these things are the third-party doctrine. You've given them up to Google, to Facebook. You don't have any expectation of privacy in them, so we get to have them willy-nilly. Well, not willy-nilly, because there's a statute. There's the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, and it has a weird rule. It says if information is stored for less than 180 days, then they have to get a warrant, and if it's over 180 days, they can get it with a much lower standard, with a subpoena. And you say, wow, that seems like a really crazy rule. And this was because that law came about in an era of bulletin board systems where if somebody, you know, looked at their email, they would download it to their computer, and if it was still on the server 6 months later, they figured, that person abandoned it, they didn't really care about it or whatnot, so they didn't need to have a warrant. And they didn't conceive of the notion of like a, you know, webmail service that would store years and years worth of messages. In any event, in some courts have found that nevertheless the Fourth Amendment requires a warrant to get your email messages despite the third party doctrine. The Sixth Circuit in particular, which is the federal courts are divided up into various circuits. We're in the 11th Circuit right now. But in the Sixth Circuit, it's clear that you need to have a warrant. But fortunately, a number of the service providers, Google and Facebook and others, say, we're going to insist upon a warrant anyway. We believe that a warrant is required, and so we're not going to give it up without a warrant. And that's actually been pretty successful.
So building off of that, there's sort of two thoughts that I think may be worth taking away from this discussion. One is the statute, the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or the Stored Communications Act, which is the subsection, does require the government to do something to force or to kind of pull the hand of a private party to like give over information that they've stored for you, whether it, you know, less than a warrant, but still, in theory, not just like let's go crazy, you know, give us everything. But there's also an important distinction between public and private. So you know, Gmail, Google, you know, large reputable companies usually have some policy about what that you store with them they will access and when. But that's privately driven. And so there's nothing really legally, aside from what the company binds itself with, to prevent a private party from looking at the communications that you store with them. And so there's a big divide in terms of how the public and the private can work with information that you've stored elsewhere. And private parties can tend to share things with other private parties. And it's only in that relationship between the private and the government where these rules about there needing to be actual judicial involvement kind of pop up.
Which is why it's so interesting, the NSA issue, I think, because if you kind of looked at it as a practical matter, that's what they're doing. Their programs are essentially gathering all this information anyway. Now, they may do it over in an undersea cable somewhere else outside the country, and then their lawyers will come out with opinions and say, yeah, this is legal, it's not in the United States. So that's sort of the, you know, little loopholes like that. They'll get the information anyway. This is kind of the way it's looking. But yeah, electronic privacy information or
communications.
Right. I mean, they don't really apply to outside of the United States. Is kind of what the problem is. And everything's connected throughout the world. You can access the same data in the United States, of certain nodes versus, you know, outside undersea cable, just outside our jurisdiction. So.
Or I guess what Blair might be getting at that maybe makes this really concrete is that you might send your email from the United States to someone in the United States using a service that you think of as based in the United States, like Google or Yahoo. But you know, they'll store they have, you know, because they want to provide a good service, they have many copies of those emails in different storage facilities, some of which are not necessarily in the United States. And so one kind of workaround that wasn't conceived of necessarily decades and decades ago to the ability of the US government to get communications by US citizens is that if it is going outside the United States, a lot of these procedural requirements don't exist. And so, you know,
finish up. I might have to disagree with you on that.
So you know, I mean, the
Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act protects U.S. persons.
Yeah, but the communication that is stored in Google's storage units that are holding your email, the U.S. government can do a search of those storage facilities without triggering a requirement to involving the U.S. person who is in the United States. So I don't mean communications going between the U.S. and a foreign person.
Well, yeah,
that's
little,
FISA.
Little nuances,
but I mean,
like
if the communication happens to go outside, searching it outside the United States would not trigger that.
Yeah, it depends on whether there are two people who are supposedly in the United States communicating versus.
Well, I mean, we may be going down a bit of a rat hole here.
Yeah, sorry.
There is an interesting thing that happened recently where Microsoft was asked by a U.S. court to provide emails that it was storing in Ireland, they're currently refusing to do so. They fought it in the court. The court said they had to give it up, they are appealing and refusing to comply with that order. I mean, in sort of a friendly way, they didn't want to give it up before the appeals court gets to weigh in. Mm-hmm.
So I have a question about sort of the GPS tracker. You know, basically they said you needed a warrant to do that, even though you could physically do it yourself, you just can't go and do that. So there is some idea that just because you can do it legally by as a police officer, you can't necessarily do it using technology. And then in the Supreme Court ruling with the cell phone case, the idea of aggregation of data, you know, you get, yeah, I got a piece of paper, I mean, you can look at it, but the cell phone's just vastly different. What do you think is going to happen with, like, license plate readers where they track your location, like in Georgia, they keep your location from license plate readers for 5 years?
The first case you mentioned was sort of decided not on the reasonable expectation of privacy kind of philosophy or doctrine. It was the fact that it was that person's property that, like, a device was attached to, and there's sort of a separate judicial doctrine for that. So with the license plate reader thing, there's not really, you're not attaching a device to anything. And so there's been precedent holding that, you know, simply observing a car is, you don't have an expectation of privacy in that. So you don't need a warrant for that. So that's kind of the difference, is that one involved a person's property and a device was attached to it. And that was sort of like a trespass onto that person's property. So I don't see the cases going favorably for.
Well, maybe we should think of it in terms of the sort of theme of where the court might be going. So Blair's absolutely right. So the Jones case, they ended up deciding it going way back to that idea of, like, if you touch something and then gather information, that's kind of like a search. And that happened to be how the court decided the case, because they physically stuck the GPS tracker on the car. And immediately everyone was like, well, what if you had a drone following it? What if you had some sort of service that was, or technology that didn't physically touch the car doing exactly the same thing? Surely that is also not going to be okay. And the concurrence of Alito and of Sotomayor kind of proposed different ways of thinking about it that might have also gotten to the same result. Like, you know, the aggregation of all the information is different in kind, and so we should look at it that way. Alito saying, you know, we should be trying to get the same amount of privacy we had back in 1790 and change the rules, as, you know, in order to get there. And so In the license plate case, it might be that that's a minimum, that's close enough to what people could see. You know, you could have a, it's not insane to think of an officer just sitting there writing down license plates, so they might say, that's fine. But, you know, I think it's a little bit open how the use of technology to gather information, the law about that will develop. So I think Blair's right that right now that's fine, but I'm a little open to the idea that some of these things might change in the future.
Well, I like hearing that I'm right, just so you know.
Yeah, I mean, you also see us raising a good point about the concurrences, which is one of the more interesting things about Jones, is that there are ways, you know, the court's decision was a bit divided and different members of the court went in different directions, but you can actually add together five justices to who agreed on particular points that were not part of the main decision. So this is a really strong clue, though, that should that issue come up before them again, you'll have five justices that would agree with the points that they separately raised. And I think it would be fair to make an argument that that this is actually automated license plate readers is one of these differences of kind that even though you could have a person doing it, it is fundamentally altering how technology is fundamentally altering how that affects people and how that affects people's privacy.
Yeah, I've got the thing. I'm kind of curious to hear if you guys are actually optimistic, because from my perspective, it's game over. It's kind of pointless. I mean, seriously, the panopticon is too strong at this point. The government doesn't play. When they get caught, they change the rules. And, you know, when your government's doing that, it's hard for me to find any optimism at all. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that front. So.
Well, I think the EFF guy would be the best. But they have a case, a Juul case, where the government has done kind of that. And I mean, they've given retroactive immunity to telecoms and stuff like that. But so, like, with this recent case, though, I think, like, across the board, most civil liberties organizations have viewed it as very positive. So, and if you read the opinion, I would encourage anyone to read it. It's very, just Chief Justice Roberts writes very well, and it's really easy to understand. You don't have to be an attorney. And it's just a pleasure to actually read the opinion. Cause, I mean, it sounds weird, but it's really well written. So,
I am an optimist. I think that we're all trying to fight for a better future, a future that is not going to be a dystopian state, but something that we would want to live in, where we want our children to grow up in. And people are more and more recognizing that these issues are important and that we can't just sort of allow, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should do something. And we're getting courts to start to recognize this, start to move away from some of the doctrines that had been problematic in the past. We are getting legislatures who are becoming slowly but more aware of these kinds of issues. I mean, one of the things that gives me hope on the legislative front is the SOPA legislation. This is about a copyright issue, but it was some pretty terrible legislation that Congress was all set to pass, and then a lot of people spoke up against it, and it got killed because it was going to fundamentally alter the internet, and people didn't want to see that. So there's a lot of, you know, possibilities of surveillance, and the technology is out there to track your every move and be some really scary things. But if we as a people have the will to try and put in the policies in place that would restrict that, would limit the government's access to it, and try to basically protect ourselves through policies, procedures, transparency, checks and balances, I think we can go forward and move into a place where we balance between our civil liberties and these technologies that can track everything.
I think I share your pessimism about the executive branch, because there's such a tendency to try to aggregate power. And once technology exists, like, it's kind of like the cows have left the barn in some sense. It's very hard to say, well, we're going to choose never to use this, or we're going to choose not to do this. But I do think there's potential on two fronts. One, like Kurt was saying, if people really get involved and care about these issues, then there's the possibility of momentum. And also, I think these last two Supreme Court cases that we've been talking about today indicate that the Supreme Court might make fairly like clear black and white rules that propose real limitations. Like, I think some of the most protective parts of our law are where the Supreme Court has been like, no, we're not joking. No laws restricting speech, with minor exceptions, da-da-da. And the way, you know, I know this is, I'm sure people in the room have different opinions either way, but if you look at the way the court has been like, no, when we said people have a right to have an abortion, we really mean it, and they keep coming back and being like, no, no, no. And I think if these kinds of issues become like those, where the Supreme Court becomes very, or a majority of the court becomes very dedicated to saying, no, these are really people's rights, we're gonna keep smacking you down until you fall in line, then I think there is a lot of potential for there to be some protection.
So, shifting gears just a bit, I record every interaction I ever have with police. It's just what I do. Watching, you see videos of people doing that more and more frequently, where a cop in a perhaps broad interpretation of executing his duties might shut off the phone, shut off the camera, and next thing you know, you got a picture of a guy with a busted up face. Are there any current cases that you guys are aware of? Or is there any case law that's gone through that rules on when and if it is permissible for a cop to shut down somebody's camera while they're recording them?
Well, there was a case in the First Circuit. This is the circuit in New England around the Massachusetts area, which held that there was a right to record the police.
And
if you have a right to record them and they bust your face, you should sue them. You can sue the police for violating your rights.
Sure. Has it happened? Has anybody successfully done that? With all of these cases where there's obvious this is happening. So what's the
In the First Circuit case, they didn't like bust the guy's face, but they shut down the phone. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Whatever came of that pepper spray incident? Anyone remember that? Where the students were protesting and they all got pepper sprayed. That video,
UC Davis,
right? I heard he got like a pension and like a big bonus or something. Right. But yeah, I think it's a good thing that you have the ability to. I mean, that's a pretty broad statement, but I think it's a good thing that you have the ability to record the police, or you should, anyways. I mean, those are good examples, like. You know, it doesn't shock me at all that you're recording the police every encounter. I think that's a good idea sometimes. So,
but. Hi, we talked about the Fifth Amendment with respect to giving up things you know, like a password or a PIN code. There were some concerns when the new iPhone came out about the fingerprint reader. So, biometrics in general, can you be compelled to give up something that you don't know, but just something that you are? Do you know if there have been any more developments on that or any discussions there?
So there's an old case where having to give blood and having to be tested doesn't count as testimonial because you're not saying anything. They're just getting sort of physical information about you. And so there's some law in that regard that says that's not testimonial. You're not saying something. You're not giving up something in your mind. Because the iPhone is, private, it's sort of like it's Apple's choice whether or not to put that into the phone, and your choice whether or not to buy it. So that's a little, maybe that's sort of outside the Fifth Amendment area, unless you mean it in a different way.
Well, they can take your fingerprint and. Well, I don't know if a case has actually come up directly hitting on those facts, but it's absolutely a concern. Like, if you're worried about that, if you have the fingerprint on the phone, you should also have a PIN code, which is possible. I mean, the fingerprint, it's convenient because it is a lot easier to put your finger on it than pushing a couple of buttons, but you're at least better off protecting it with a couple of buttons, or you can do it in addition to the fingerprint.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Hello. Hi. Okay. Just a few days before the Supreme Court ruling, I started getting a bunch of spam from a friend of mine. I messaged her back, said, why am I getting spam from you over Facebook? And then she replied back a few days later saying she was arrested by the police officers of Cleveland, Ohio. I'm not going to say her name, but I will mention the Cleveland Police Department. It was amazing that for some weird reason she started sending out spam the same day her phone was confiscated by the police department. What are we doing to protect ourselves on a street level, not just, you know, protecting servers and stuff and doing things with court appeals and so that on a street level when you're stopped by the police department, if they empty your pockets and they go through and they start looking at your phone, that can be pretty much a strip search of both you and every friend which you have on that phone at that time. And I think we really need to work towards having some kind of sanction against police officers for doing that, because we would not allow them to pull our pants down in the middle of the street. Why should they be allowed to pull up our phone system?
I'm trying to think of what technologically might have happened there. And my instinct is that it might just be a coincidence that her Facebook was hacked when
the
she was arrested.
The same day?
Well, only because a lot of the spamming operations are, you know, people in other countries trying to hack passwords into accounts all the time. Like, you know.
Really coincidental, though. I mean, it's really.
It's
coincidental.
We'll never know but it's kind of a pain in the ass to send spam over a phone.
Okay.
Like, if you want to send spam, you're much better off just, you know, buying the services of a couple thousand computer botnet and having them send the spam, and, you know, cost you a couple of bucks and off goes the spam.
Leaving aside the spam comment, but again, checking, just a police officer just going through your gallery.
Well, I mean, this is the whole point. Yeah, you need a warrant for that, and absolutely. So if the police are going to go through your phone and they don't get a warrant for it, then you can exclude the evidence that they may find if they violated the warrant requirement.
Well, that's another sort of.
How would you know, though, if they just grabbed your? Sorry to cut you off. Well, how would you know, though, if they just grabbed your nude pics off there and just kept them on their laptop?
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Yeah. Okay.
I mean, this speaks to why self-help is important, right? Like, the exclusionary rule only protects you if someone tries to introduce something they discover in court when you're being criminally charged with something. But there's other kinds of bad things that can happen when someone gets information about you that aren't going to be used against you in court. And so, you know, it maybe one can criticize the way we do this in general for not being adequately protective of those kinds of situations.
Right, so you all hear about these hacking scandals with Target and these other companies. Well, just imagine the federal government being hacked by a foreign government with everybody's personal information, financial habits, everything. So that's a real problem, even if, you know, our government is using the information properly, you know, then other governments can hack into it and stuff. That's one of the big dangers. Just even the fact they collect it, that's a risk. So.
I have a question for you guys, actually, which is how, in practice, given, so you can still seize the phone, and then you get a warrant, and then you can search it later, and so, you know, there'll be some delay, but I wonder how much of an effect this will have practically on what kind of evidence gets introduced in cases and whatnot. Possibly not all that much.
Well, I think actually the other hole, if you will, is consent. They'll just ask people, can I look at your phone? And turns out, actually, a lot of people will consent. Don't do this.
Don't consent.
Do not consent to the search of your phone. But they'll ask for a lot of consent. And then, yeah, and then the police will take the phone, put it into a bag that blocks signals so you can't do a remote wipe, and then they'll get a warrant later if they have a good reason for it. So I think it's kind of just going to prevent opportunistic ones where they're just sort of looking at the phone just to see what's there, and they don't really have a good reason for it. If they're arresting you for a major crime, and they can convince a court pretty easily that there might be evidence of that crime on the phone.
Absolutely. So, given that many of us are encouraged to use our mobile devices at work, and not only use them for work, just getting email, but also some of us even work with applications that are used to collaborate in the workspace, including storing confidential company information on our personal devices. Have there been any cases around your culpability, not only in terms of your own, now you've got two things to worry about, your personal information and also the confidential if you signed an NDA for your company and yet you're required to use your mobile device in that setting?
Well, there's a big problem I see there because, you know, as an attorney, I have to protect, you know, the attorney-client. As an attorney, I have to really kind of adhere to the attorney-client privilege. And so, you know, I take things like kind of very literally. So I think both Gmail has a lot of my client information on their servers, or Google does. And so how do I protect against that? And so, you know, there are ways like to use email encryption and stuff like that. But really the technology is sort of lagging behind, you know, what's out there. And they're just now coming out with products like phones that are encrypted, you know, like the black phone, I can't remember, you know, email that is really truly encrypted, even, you know, from the sender and recipient information, that kind of stuff. So I mean, there are steps you can do, there are browser add-ons you can add, there's all sorts of little programs, but really against like a sophisticated entity, you're not going to be protected at this point, I don't think.
But maybe addressing what I think you might have been getting at, you know, if you sign a specific document, a lot of things depend on what the document says, but the sort of general state of like trade secret law and your duty of loyalty to your employer and all of that, usually there's usually an element of knowingly or willingly or wildly recklessly letting information get out. And so, you know, if you have a work phone and it gets hacked into, or, you know, you're arrested and the government gets the information and somehow shares it, that's not the kind of thing where you're going to have a problem with your employer for violating, you know, your agreement to keep something secret, very, very generally speaking, because I'm not thinking of whatever your specific situation is. But I mean, sort of the general state of sort of like trade secret law in general requires you to kind of be like participatory in some manner.
A question about data destruction. You know, the old BlackBerries, they could obviously be remote wiped, but there are encryption algorithms that expire after a certain amount of time. And then connectivity has become a constant. So what is going to be a culpability if you're arrested, they take your phone, and you deliberately wipe a key that's on the network, or, you know, it happens automatically because you've got a, say, a contract or a legal document that's in draft form,
mm-hmm.
and there's agreement that will not be exposed because it's still being what is going to be the restriction? I say I've got sales records or something that's a trade secret or something, and I don't want it getting out, and I go out and click on the web, and that key's gone. You can't ask me for the key because it's too large for a human to know.
Well, you're raising a couple of different issues there. I think one of them is sort of this, you know, if your phone is seized by the police, remote wiping it to make it so the police can't get that information, or doing something that stops them from getting it. The police may go ahead and charge an obstruction of justice or destruction of evidence for that, and in some cases that actually will be a more serious charge than what they might have been doing originally. So that there's some pretty hefty risks with destroying information on your phone after it has been seized, and may end up actually being a worse thing.
Someone on the panel earlier mentioned that in the most recent case, the Supreme Court made statements that were significant along with the ruling. Can you summarize those statements, the most salient ones, and can you distinguish if they were doctrine or dicta?
I have some quotes here.
I mean, they're mostly, you know, the holding of the case is that you need a warrant unless you're falling under one of the other exceptions like exigency. But there's some just great lines that are very, like pithy.
I'll give you my one of my favorites was that the government had been suggesting that everything would be okay because they put in some procedures in place would protect people, and the court said the founders didn't fight a revolution for government procedures.
Right.
And they also relayed the story of general warrants. So This is something that prior to the revolution, the British had a system called general warrants, where you get a warrant to look for evidence of, you know, often it was tax evasion, things like that, customs information, and it was not specific to a particular person or a particular place. It was just a warrant. You could go through anybody's house with this warrant and look for the evidence. And this was one of the things that very much upset the colonists, having the government rummage through their stuff. There's a line about this, which is in there, but.
Which one?
Otis is like.
Oh, the first speech that gave birth to the.
Yeah. John Adams was there, and he would later write that every man of a crowded audience appeared to me to go away, as I did, ready to take arms against writs of assistance.
Yeah, and that's when independence. Child liberty was born?
Yeah, something like that.
That's probably in here somewhere.
That's why you should read the opinion, I'm telling you.
I'm going to read a paragraph while Kurt finds the line that he's looking for that I really liked, which is, modern cell phones are not just another technological convenience. With all they contain and all they may reveal, they hold for many Americans the privacies of life. The fact that technology now allows an individual to carry such information in his hand does not make the information any less worthy of the protection for which the founders fought. Our answer to the question of what the police must do before searching a cell phone seized incident to arrest is accordingly simple. Get a warrant. Period.
Come back with a warrant.
And that's why I like this case so much, is it's not, you know, it doesn't dance around these, like, you know, adding 20 intricacies, there's a 20-factor test, we balance interests, da-da-da. It's very simple and straightforward, and I think that kind of leads the door open for a sense that we're kind of moving in a very liberty-focused direction here, where the rules should be fairly clear and not allow a lot of wiggle room for the government to find room to abuse those kind of fuzzy areas that sometimes appear in law.
One thing I found that was kind of fascinating too, kind of touching on your question, was that the court addressed the argument raised by the government, I believe, that it's sort of like analogs is what they refer to. Like, so for example, if you have a photograph that's found in a person's pocket, they said, well, since that would be legal to obtain when you search incident to an arrest, so should all the photographs on a person's phone. There's no difference between a single photograph in a person's physical pocket versus thousands of photographs on a phone. So that's where the court really went into the qualitative, you know, the the quantity and the inherent nature differences between the smartphone and technology kind of in general, you know, versus just what you might find on a person. Because, and so Chief Justice Roberts talking about, you know, a phone, you know, it's also a camera, it's a banking tool, it's email, it's whatever, it has all these different functions, and these analogs, you know, like a letter or a diary, like they're just different, like in the phone context, all bundled into one huge thing, basically. And so the opinion is really good at that, and that's part of the reasoning, but the holding is what you read, is that, you know, the warrant is required before.
Yeah, basically.
Right now. But the reasoning is like what lawyers use a lot of time to go before a court and you know, argue their clients' cases and stuff. So.
And there's just great analogies in there. Like, you know, the equivalent of this pre-digital age would be to have to drag behind you a trunk, which, in fact, you would need a search warrant to search anyway, right? Most people can't lug around every piece of mail they received for the past several months, every picture they have taken, every book or article they have read, nor would they have any reason to attempt to do so. It's a really simple holding, but there's just lovely language in there that I think will be used in future cases, and I think that's why it's an interesting and good case.
Yeah, we'll certainly be quoting a lot of this case in future briefs. You know, there's a lot of what you do when you write a brief to the court is you say, well, the situation before the court now is similar to the situation that the Supreme Court has already said. So it's often a battle of these analogies where, you know, the government might say, well, it's more similar to this past case, and you say it's more similar to that past case. And there's a lot of good language here that is describing, you could call it doctrine, I guess, but it's describing sort of the types of circumstances that they were concerned about, that you could use to analogize it to other circumstances. So, easy ones would be like, you know, an iPad or a tablet, but you can say also they were saying one of the reasons they were concerned about cell phones was because they were like small computers. Well, so you can certainly use this to say this should hold for computers as well, and so on. There's a lot of possibilities that come out of this case.
So one quick comment that I find very interesting. I work in IT for a hospital, and there are two major medical laws that are out. There's obviously the HIPAA, but there's something called the High Tech Act, which is not high tech at all. And it's really interesting that the government is pushing for sharing of information and actually requiring hospitals and doctors to comply with this. And if we don't, we're going to be hit with massive fines. And what that information is getting your data and emailing, sharing, having you access it through portals that we supposedly create and maintain security and eventually develop apps for this. And my concern with it is the protections aren't there. The technology is still very primitive. So I would just encourage you guys, if you start getting that from your medical people, be very careful, because there's a reason in my book why the government wants this stuff to be all shareable. So just be aware of it and have your privacy radar go off, because it's still very primitive. My question for you guys is on your cell phone, so when they get that search warrant and they're allowed to access your phone, you have all these individual apps that have potentially passwords, or maybe you're one of these who have them conveniently linked so your password's already in there. And let's say you've got the Mayo Clinic app and they can just plop on there and now they're in your medical chart. Are they allowed to do that, or do they have to get a separate warrant to get your medical information, a separate warrant to get your banking information, even though they technically could get it off your phone?
I would certainly argue that they do, but I don't know if that has been yet addressed.
Yeah, I would say there's a bit of an open question with how far. So there's the information you get the warrant to search the computer. There's information on the computer, and there's information that's on a different computer that you can access from your computer. And I think, if they're doing if they're taking an image of the computer and searching the files, they're not going to be able to get things that are not on it. If someone's physically sitting there pushing buttons, I'm not sure exactly where the line would be drawn.
Because it's so easy, it's a 10-second.
Yeah. But if they're, usually when they're doing a forensic search, they make a copy of the computer, they make a copy of the files on the computer and they search that, in which case it's not sort of the same experience as, you're pushing buttons and typing things. So that in that case, they're only looking at the data that was on the hard drive.
Yeah, one thing about warrants in general is that you have to specify, I don't know the legalese, but I think it's reasonable particularity or something, but you have to specify the things and like the areas to be searched, what you're looking for. And so you could argue, at least, as an attorney or whatnot, that, you can't just search every single app. You have to search anything. But again, that would be, I'm not aware of any cases right now that have addressed that issue.
But, what will be interesting is in practice, let's say it's not to do a forensic search, but it's like, I want to turn it on and open this app. And it might not even be clear to the police what parts are on the computer and which parts are being reached from, using a connection to another, to information on another computer.
Right.
And so if it's like, I want to see what the person is doing in this app or in this program, they might not know. The warrant might say that you can open this app, open this program. And then, even if they go outside of it, but it was in like legitimate good faith, like, oh, I thought this data was on the computer and I just pushed the button and there it was, that would probably be let in. But, it's...
plain view.
There's always an exception to that.
Or just good faith. Like, I thought it was on the hard drive. I just clicked the button. It appeared right in front of me. How was I supposed to know it was accessing something else?
Okay, I think we're out of time, folks.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, everybody.
Yay.